He pushed back her shoulders with his hands. Let them see that you have a woman's shape now. His fingers brushed lightly over her budding breasts and tightened on a nipple. You will not fail me tonight. If you do, it will go hard for you. You don't want to wake the dragon, do you? His fingers twisted her, the pinch cruelly hard through the rough fabric of her tunic. Do you? He repeated. No, said Danny meekly. Her brother smiled. Good. He touched her hair almost with affection. When they write the history of my reign, sweet sister, they will say that it began tonight. When he was gone, Danny went to her window and looked out wistfully on the waters of the bay. The square brick towers of Pentos were black silhouettes outlined against the setting sun. Danny could hear the singing of the red priests as they lit the night fires and the shouts of ragged children playing games beyond the walls of the estate. For a moment she wished she could be out there with them, barefoot and breathless and dressed in tatters, with no past, no future, and no feast to attend at Khal Drogo's manse. Somewhere beyond the sunset, across the narrow sea, lay a land of green hills and flowered plains and great rushing rivers, where towers of dark stone rose amidst magnificent blue-gray mountains, and armored knights rode to battle beneath the banners of their lords. The Dothraki call that land Reush Andali, the land of the Andals. In the free cities they talked of Westeros and the Sunset Kingdoms. Her brother had a simpler name. Our land, he called it. The words were like a prayer with him. If he said them enough, the gods were sure to hear. Ours by blood right. Taken from us by treachery. But ours still, ours forever. You do not steal from the dragon. Oh, no. The dragon remembers. And perhaps the dragon did remember. But Danny could not. She had never seen this land her brother said was theirs, this realm beyond the narrow sea. These places he talked of, Casterly Rock and the Eyrie, High Garden and the Vale of Erin, Dawn and the Isle of Faces, they were just words to her. Viserys had been a boy of 8 when they fled the King's Landing to escape the advancing armies of the usurper, but Daenerys had been only a quickening in her mother's womb. Yet sometimes Danny would picture the way it had been. So often had her brother told her the stories. The midnight flight to Dragonstone, moonlight shimmering on the ship's black sails, her brother Rhaegar battling the usurper in the bloody waters of the Trident and dying for the woman he loved. The sack of King's Landing, by the ones Viserys called the usurper's dogs, the Lords Lannister and Stark, Princess Elia of Dawn, pleading for mercy as Rhaegar's heir was ripped from her breast and murdered before her eyes. The polished skulls of the last dragon staring down sightlessly from the walls of the throne room, while the Kingslayer opened father's throat with a golden sword. She had been born on Dragonstone 9 moons after their flight, while a raging summer storm threatened to rip the island fastness apart. They said that storm was terrible. The Targaryen fleet was smashed while it lay at anchor, and huge stone blocks were ripped from the parapets and sent hurtling into the wild waters of the narrow sea. Her mother had died birthing her, and for that her brother, Viserys, had never forgiven her. She did not remember Dragonstone either. They had run again, just before the usurper's brother set sail with his new-built fleet. By then only Dragonstone itself, the ancient seat of the house, had remained of the 7 kingdoms that had once been theirs. It would not remain for long. The garrison had been prepared to sell them to the usurper, but one night Sir Willem Darry and 4 loyal men had broken into the nursery and stolen them both, along with her wet nurse, and set sail under cover of darkness for the safety of the Bravosian coast. She remembered Sir Willem, dimly, a great grey bear of a man, half-blind, roaring and bellowing orders from his sickbed. The servants had lived in terror of him, but he had always been kind to Danny. He called her Little Princess, and sometimes My Lady, and his hands were soft as old leather. He never left his bed, though, and the smell of sickness clung to him day and night, a hot, moist, sickly, sweet odour. That was when they lived in Braavos, in the big house with the red door. Danny had her own room there, with a lemon tree outside her window. After Sir Willem had died, the servants had stolen what little money they had left, and soon after they had been put out of the big house. Danny had cried when the red door closed behind them forever. They had wandered since then, from Braavos to Myr, from Myr to Tyrosh, and on to Cohor, and Volantis, and Lice, never staying long in any one place. Her brother would not allow it. The usurper's hard knives were close behind them, he insisted, though Danny had never seen one. At first the magisters and archons and merchant princes were pleased to welcome the last Targaryens to their homes and tables, but as the years passed and the usurper continued to sit upon the Iron Throne, doors closed and their lives grew meaner. Years passed, they had been forced to sell their last few treasures, and now even the coin they had gotten from Mother's crown had gone. In the alleys and wine sinks of Pentos, they called her brother the Beggar King. Danny did not want to know what they called her. "We will have it all back some day, sweet sister," he would promise her. Sometimes his hand shook when he talked about it. "The jewels and the silks, Dragonstone and King's Landing, the Iron Throne and the Seven Kingdoms, all they have taken from us, we will have it back." Viserys lived for that day. All that Daenerys wanted back was the big house with the red door, the lemon tree outside her window, the childhood she had never known. There came a soft knock on her door. "Come," Danny said, turning away from the window. Illyrio's servants entered, bowed, and set about their business. They were slaves, a gift from the magister's many Dothraki friends. There was no slavery in the free city of Pentos. Nonetheless, they were slaves. The old woman, small and grey as a mouse, never said a word. But the girl made up for it. She was Illyrio's favourite, a fair-haired, blue-eyed wench of 16 who chattered constantly as she worked. They filled her bath with hot water, brought up from the kitchen, and scented it with fragrant oils. The girl pulled the rough cotton tunic over Danny's head and helped her into the tub. The water was scalding hot, but Daenerys did not flinch or cry out. She liked the heat. It made her feel clean. Besides, her brother had often told her it was never too hot for a Targaryen. "Ours is the house of the dragon," he would say. "The fire is in our blood." The old woman washed her long, silver-pale hair and gently combed out the snags, all in silence. The girl scrubbed her back and her feet and told her how lucky she was.
"Drogo is so rich that even his slaves wear golden collars. 100,000 men ride in his Khalasar, and his palace in Vaes Dothrak hath 200 rooms and doors of solid silver."
There was more like that, so much more. What a handsome man the Carl was, so tall and fierce, fearless in battle, the best rider ever to mount a horse, a demon archer. Daenerys said nothing. She had always assumed that she would wed Viserys when she came of age. For centuries the Targaryens had married brother to sister, since Aegon the Conqueror had taken his sisters to bride. The line must be kept pure, Viserys had told her 1,000 times. Theirs was the king's blood, the golden blood of old Valyria, the blood of the dragon. Dragons did not mate with the beasts of the field, and Targaryens did not mingle their blood with that of lesser men. Yet now Viserys schemed to sell her to a stranger, a barbarian. When she was clean, the slaves helped her from the water and toweled her dry. The girl brushed her hair until it shone like molten silver, while the old woman anointed her with the spice flower perfume of the Dothraki plains, a dab on each wrist, behind her ears, on the tip of her breasts, and one last one, cool on her lips, down there between her legs. They dressed her in the wisps that Magister Illyrio had sent up, and then the gown, a deep plum silk, to bring out the violet in her eyes. The girl slid the gilded sandals onto her feet, while the old woman fixed the tiara in her hair and slid golden bracelets crusted with amethysts around her wrists. Last of all came the collar, a heavy gold torque emblazoned with ancient Valyrian glyphs.
"Now you look all a princess," the girl said breathlessly when they were done.
Danny glanced at her image in the silvered-looking glass that Illyrio had so thoughtfully provided. "A princess," she thought. But she remembered what the girl had said, how Khal Drogo was so rich even his slaves wore golden collars. She felt a sudden chill, and goose flesh pimpled her bare arms. Her brother was waiting in the cool of the entry hall, seated on the edge of the pool, his hand trailing in the water. He rose when she appeared and looked her over critically.
"Stand there," he told her. "Turn around. Yes, good. You look..."
"Regal," Master Illyrio said, stepping through an archway. He moved with surprising delicacy for such a massive man. Beneath loose garments of flame-colored silk, rows of fat jiggled as he walked. Gemstones glittered on every finger, and his man had oiled his forked yellow beard until it shone like real gold. "May the Lord of Light shower you with blessings on this most fortunate day, Princess Daenerys," the Magister said as he took her hand. He bowed his head, showing a thin glimpse of crooked yellow teeth through the gold of his beard. "She is a vision, Your Grace, a vision," he told her brother. "Drogo will be enraptured."
"She's too skinny," Viserys said. His hair, the same silver blonde as hers, had been pulled back tightly behind his head and fastened with a dragon bone brooch. It was a severe look that emphasized the hard, gaunt lines of his face. He rested his hand on the hilt of the sword that Illyrio had lent him and said, "Are you sure that Khal Drogo likes his women this young?"
"She has had her blood. She is old enough for the Khal," Illyrio told him, not for the first time. "Look at her, the silver-gold hair, those purple eyes. She is the blood of old Valyria, no doubt, no doubt. And high-born, daughter of the old king, sister to the new, she cannot fail to entrance our Drogo."
When he released her hand, Daenerys found herself trembling. "I suppose," her brother said doubtfully, "the savages have queer tastes, Boys, horses, sheep."
"Best not suggest this to Khal Drogo," Illyria said. Anger flashed in her brother's lilac eyes.
"Do you take me for a fool?"
The Magister bowed slightly. "I take you for a king. Kings lack the caution of common men. My apologies if I have given offence." He turned away and clapped his hands for his bearers.
The streets of Pentos were pitch dark when they set out in Illyrio's elaborately carved palanquin. Two servants went ahead to light their way, carrying ornate oil lanterns with panes of pale blue glass, while a dozen strong men hoisted the poles to their shoulders. It was warm and close inside behind the curtains. Danny could smell the stench of Illyrio's pallid flesh through his heavy perfumes. Her brother sprawled out on the pillows beside her, never noticed. His mind was away across a narrow sea.
"We won't need his held Khalasar," Viserys said.
His fingers toyed with the hilt of his borrowed blade, though Danny knew he had never used the sword in earnest.
10,000, that would be enough. I could sweep the Seven Kingdoms with 10,000 Dothraki screamers. The realm will rise for its rightful king. Tyrell, Redwyn, Dary, Greyjoy, they have no more love for the usurper than I do. The Dornish men burn to avenge Ilya and her children, and the small folk will be with us. They cry out for their king." He looked at Illyrio anxiously.
"Well, they do, don't they?"
"They are your people, and they love you well," Master Illyrio said amiably. "In Holdfast across the realm, men lift secret toasts to your health, while women sew dragon banners and hide them against the day of your return from across the water." He gave a massive shrug. "Or so my agents tell me."
Danny had no agents.
no way of knowing what anyone was doing or thinking across the narrow sea, but she mistrusted Illyrio's sweet words, as she mistrusted everything about Illyrio. Her brother was nodding eagerly, however. "I shall kill the usurper myself," he promised, who had never killed anyone, "as he killed my brother Rhaegar and Lannister too, the Kingslayer, for what he did to my father." "That would be most fitting," Magister Illyrio said. Danny saw the smallest hint of a smile playing around his full lips, but her brother did not notice. Nodding, he pushed back a curtain and stared off into the night, and Danny knew he was fighting the Battle of the Trident once again. The nine tarred manse of Khal Drogo sat beside the waters of the bay, its high brick walls overgrown with pale ivy. It had been given to the Khal by the magisters of Pentos, Illyrio told them. "The free cities were always generous with the horse lords. It is not that we fear these barbarians," Illyrio would explain with a smile. "The Lord of Light would hold our city walls against 1,000,000 Dothraki, or so the Red Priest promise. Yet why take chances when their friendship comes so cheap?" Their palanquin was stopped at the gate, the curtains pulled roughly back by one of the house guards. He had the copper skin and dark almond eyes of a Dothraki, but his face was hairless, and he wore the spiked bronze cap of the Unsullied. He looked them over coldly. Magister Illyrio growled something to him in the rough Dothraki tongue. The guardsman replied in the same voice and waved them through the gates. Danny noticed that her brother's hand was clenched tightly around the hilt of his borrowed sword. He looked almost as frightened as she felt. "Insolent eunuch," Viserys muttered, as a palanquin lurched up toward the manse. Magister Illyrio's words were honey. "Many important men will be at the feast tonight. Such men have enemies. The Khal must protect his guests. Yourself chief among them, your grace. No doubt the usurper would pay well for your head."
"Oh, yes," Viserys said darkly. "He has tried, Illyrio, I promise that. His hard knives follow us everywhere. I'm the last dragon, and he will not sleep easy while I live."
The palanquin slowed and stopped. The curtains were thrown back, and a slave offered a hand to help Daenerys out. His colour, she noted, was ordinary bronze. Her brother followed, one hand still clenched hard around his sword hilt. It took two strong men to get Magister Illyrio back on his feet. Inside the manse, the air was heavy with the scent of spices, pinched fire and sweet lemon and cinnamon. They were escorted across the entry hall, where a mosaic of coloured glass depicted the doom of Valyria. Oil burned in black iron lanterns all along the walls. Beneath an arch of twining stone leaves, a eunuch sang their coming.
"Viserys of the House Targaryen, the third of his name," he called in a high, sweet voice. "King of the Andals and the Ronar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. His sister Daenerys Stormborn, Princess of Dragonstone. His honourable host, Illyrio Mepatis, Magister of the Free City of Pentos."
They stepped past the eunuch into a pillared courtyard overgrown in pale ivory. Moonlight painted the leaves in shades of bone and silver as the guests drifted among them. Many were Dothraki horse lords, big men with red brown skin, their drooping mustachios bound in metal rings, their black hair oiled and braided and hung with bells. Yet among them moved bravos and sellswords from Pentos and Myr and Tyrosh, a red priest even fatter than Illyrio, hairy men from the port of Ibon, and lords from the summer isles with skins as black as ebony. Daenerys looked at them all in wonder and realized with a sudden start of fear that she was the only woman there. Illyrio whispered to them, "Those three are Drago's blood riders there," he said. "By the pillars Carl Morrow, with his son Rhaegaro. The man with the green beard is brother to the Archon of Tyrosh, and the man behind him is Seer Jorah Mormont." The last name
court Daenerys. A knight? No less. Illyrio smiled through his beard. Anointed with the seven oils by the High Septon himself. What is he doing here? She blurted. The usurper wanted his head, Illyrio told them. Some trifling affront. He sold some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver instead of giving them to the Night's Watch. Absurd law. A man should be able to do as he likes with his own chattel. I shall wish to speak with Ser Jorah before the night is done, her brother said. Dany found herself looking at the knight curiously. He was an older man, past 40 and balding, but still strong and fit. Instead of silks and cottons, he wore wool and leather. His tunic was a dark green, embroidered with the likeness of a black bear standing on two legs. She was still looking at this strange man from the homeland she had never known, when Magister Illyrio placed a moist hand on her bare shoulder. "Over there, sweet princess," he whispered. "There is the Carl himself." Dany wanted to run and hide, but her brother was looking at her, and if she displeased him, she knew she would wake the dragon. Anxiously she turned and looked at the man Viserys hoped would ask to wed her before the night was done. The slave girl had not been far wrong, she thought. Khal Drogo was a head taller than the tallest man in the room, yet somehow light on his feet, as graceful as a panther in Illyrio's menagerie. He was younger than she'd thought, no more than 30. His skin was the colour of polished copper, his thick moustachios bound with gold and bronze rings. "I must go and make my submissions," Magister Illyrio said. "Wait here. I shall bring him to you." Her brother took her by the arm as Illyrio waddled off to the cowl, his fingers squeezing so hard that they hurt. "Do you see his braid, sweet sister?" Drogo's braid was black as midnight, and heavy with scented oil, hung with tiny bells that rang softly as he moved. It swung well past his belt, even below his buttocks, the end of it brushing against the back of his thighs. "You see how long it is?" Viserys said. "When Dothraki are defeated in combat, they cut off their braids in disgrace, so the world will know their shame. Khal Drogo has never lost a fight. He is Aegon, the Dragon Lord, come again, and you will be his queen." Dany looked at Khal Drogo. His face was hard and cruel, his eyes as cold and dark as onyx. Her brother hurt her sometimes, when she woke the dragon, but he did not frighten her the way this man frightened her. "I don't want to be his queen," she heard herself say in a small, thin voice. "Please, please, Viserys, I don't want to. I want to go home."
"Home?" He kept his voice low, but you could hear the fury in his tone. "How are we to go home, sweet sister? They took her home from us."
He drew her into the shadows out of sight, his fingers digging into her skin.
"How are we to go home?"
he repeated, meaning King's Landing and Dragonstone and all the realm they had lost. Dany had only meant their rooms and Illyrio's estate. No true home, surely, though all they had, but her brother did not want to hear that. There was no home there for him. Even the big house with the red door had not been home for him. His fingers dug hard into her arm, demanding an answer.
"I don't know," she said at last, her voice breaking, the tears welling in her eyes.
"I do," he said sharply. "We go home with an army, sweet sister, with Khal Drogo's army. That is how we go home. And if you must wed him and bet him for that, you will."
He smiled at her.
"I'll let his whole Khalasar fuck you if need be, sweet sister, all 40,000 men, and their horses too, if that was what it took to get my army. Be grateful it's only Drogo. In time, you may even learn to like him. Now dry your eyes, Illyrio is bringing him over, and he will not see you crying."
Dany turned, and saw it was true. Master Illyrio, all smiles and bows, was escorting Khal Drogo over to where they stood. She brushed away unfallen tears with the back of her hand. "Smile," Viserys whispered nervously, his hand falling to the hilt of his sword.
"And stand up straight. Let him see that you have breasts. Gods, no, you have little enough as it is.
Daenerys smiled and stood up straight. Eddard. The visitors poured to the castle gates in a river of gold and silver and polished steel. 300 strong, a pride of bannermen and knights, of sworn swords and free riders. Over their heads a dozen golden banners whipped back and forth in the northern wind, emblazoned with the crown stag of Baratheon. Ned knew many of the riders. There came Sir Jaime Lannister, with hair as bright as beaten gold, and there Sandor Clegane, with his terrible burned face. The tall boy beside him could only be the crown prince, and that stunted little man behind them was surely the imp, Tyrion Lannister. Yet the huge man at the head of the column, flanked by two knights in snow-white cloaks of the King's Guard, seemed almost a stranger to Ned, until he vaulted off the back of his war-horse with a familiar roar and crushed him in a bone-crunching hug. "Ned! Ha ha! But it's good to see that frozen face of yours!" The King looked him over from top to bottom and laughed. "You have not changed at all!" Would that Ned had been able to say the same. 15 years passed when they had ridden forth to win a throne. The Lord of Storm's End had been a clean-shaven, clear-eyed, and muscled like a maiden's fantasy. 6.5 feet tall, he towered over lesser men, and when he'd donned his armour and the great antlered helmet of his house, he became a veritable giant. He had a giant strength, too. His weapon of choice, a spiked iron war hammer that Ned could scarcely lift. In those days, the smell of leather and blood had clung to him like perfume. Now it was perfume that clung to him like perfume, and he had a girth to match his height. Ned had last seen the king 9 years before, during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion, when the stag and the dire wolf joined to end the pretensions of the self-proclaimed King of the Iron Islands. Since the night they had stood side by side in Greyjoy's fallen stronghold, where Robert had accepted the rebel lord's surrender, and Ned had taken his son Theon as hostage and ward, the king had gained at least 8 stone. A beard as coarse and black as iron wire covered his jaw to hide his double chin and the sag of his royal jowls, but nothing could hide his stomach or the dark circles under his eyes. Yet Robert was Ned's king now, not just a friend, so he said only, "Your Grace, Winterfell is yours." By then the others were dismounting as well, and grooms were coming forward for their mounts. Robert's queen, Cersei Lannister, entered on foot with her younger children. The wheelhouse in which they had ridden, a huge double-decked carriage of oiled oak and gilded metal, pulled by 40 heavy draft horses, was too wide to pass through the castle gate. Ned knelt in the snow to kiss the king's ring, while Robert embraced Catelyn like a long-lost sister. Then the children had been brought forward, introduced and approved of by both sides. No sooner had these formalities of greeting been completed than the king had said to his hosts, "Take me down to the crypt, Eddard. I would pay my respects." Ned loved him for that, for remembering her. Still, after all these years, he called for a lantern. No other words were needed. The queen had begun to protest. They had been riding since dawn. Everyone was tired and cold. Surely they should refresh themselves first. The dead would wait. She had said no more than that. Robert had looked at her, and her twin brother Jaime had taken her quietly by the arm, and she had said no more. They went down to the crypt together, Ned and this king he scarcely recognized. The winding stone steps were narrow. Ned went first for the lantern. "I was starting to think we would never reach Winterfell," Robert complained as they descended. "In the south, the way they talk about my 7 kingdoms, a man forgets that your part is as big as the other 6 combined." "I trust you enjoyed your journey, Your Grace?" Robert snorted. "Bogs and forests and fields, and scarcely a decent inn north of the Neck. I've never seen such a vast emptiness. Where are all your people?" Likely they were too shy to come out, Ned jested. He could feel the chill coming up the stairs, a cold breath from deep within the earth. Kings are a rare sight in the north. Robert snorted. More likely they were hiding under the snow. Snow, Ned! The king put one hand on the wall to steady himself as they descended. Late summer snows are common enough, Ned said. I hope they did not trouble you. They are usually mild. The others take your mild snows, Robert swore. What will this place be like in winter, I shudder to think. Well, the winters are hard, Ned admitted, but the Starks will endure, they always have. You need to come south, Robert told him. You need a taste of summer before it flees. In Highgarden there are fields of golden roses that stretch away as far as the eye can see. The fruits are so ripe, they explode in your mouth. Melons, peaches, fire plums, you've never tasted such sweetness. You'll see, I brought you some. Even at Storm's End, with that good wind off the bay, the days are so hot you can barely move. And you ought to see the towns, Ned. Flowers everywhere. The market's bursting with food. The summer wine's so cheap and so good, you can get drunk just breathing the air. Everyone is fat and drunk and rich. He laughed and slapped his own ample stomach a thump. And the girls, Ned, he exclaimed, his eyes sparkling. I swear, the women lose all modesty in the heat. They swim naked in the river, right beneath the castle. Even in the streets, it's too damned hot for wool or fur, so they go round in these short gowns. Silk, if they have the silver, and cotton if not. But it's all the same when they start sweating, and the cloth sticks to their skin. They might as well be naked. The king laughed happily. Robert Baratheon had always been a man of huge appetites, a man who knew how to take his pleasures. That was not a charge anyone could lay at the door of Eddard Stark. Yet Ned could not help but notice that those pleasures were taking a toll on the king. Robert was breathing heavily by the time they reached the bottom of the stairs, his face red in the lantern light as they stepped out into the darkness of the crypt. "Your Grace," said Ned respectfully. He swept the lantern in a wide semicircle. Shadows moved and lurched. Flickering light touched the stones underfoot and brushed against a long procession of granite pillars that marched ahead, two by two into the dark. Between the pillars, the dead sat on their stone thrones against the walls, backs against the sepulchres that contained their mortal remains. She is down at the end with Father and Brandon. He led the way between the pillars, and Robert followed wordlessly, shivering in the subterranean chill. It was always cold down there. Their footsteps rang off the stones and echoed in the vault above as they walked among the dead of House Stark. The lords of Winterfell watched them pass. Their likenesses were carved into the stones that sealed the tombs. In long rows they sat, blind eyes, staring out into eternal darkness, while great stone direwolves curled round their feet. The shifting shadows made the stone figure seem to stir as the living passed by. By ancient custom, an iron longsword had been laid across the lap of each who had been lord of Winterfell, to keep the vengeful spirits in their crypts. The oldest had long ago rusted away to nothing, leaving only a few red stains where the metal had rested on stone. Ned wondered if that meant those ghosts were free to roam the castle now. He hoped not. The first lords of Winterfell had been men hard as the land they ruled. In the centuries before the Dragon Lords came over the sea, they had sworn allegiance to no man, styling themselves the kings in the north. Ned stopped at last and lifted the oil lantern. The crypt continued on into darkness ahead of them, but beyond this point the tombs were empty and unsealed, black holes waiting for their dead, waiting for him and his children. Ned did not like to think on that. "Here," he told his king. Robert nodded silently, knelt, and bowed his head. There were three tombs, side by side. Lord Rickard Stark, Ned's father had a long, stern face. The stonemason had known him well. He sat with quiet dignity, stone fingers holding tight to the sword across his lap. But in life, all swords had failed him. In two smaller sepulchres, on either side were his children. Brandon had been 20 when he died, strangled, by order of the mad king Aerys Targaryen, only a few short days before he was to wed Catelyn Tully of Riverrun. His father had been forced to watch him die. He was a true heir, the eldest, born to rule. Lyanna had only been 16, a child woman of surpassing loveliness. Ned had loved her with all his heart. Robert had loved her even more. She was to have been his bride. "She was more beautiful than that," the king said after a silence, his eyes lingering on Lyanna's face, as if he could will her back to life. Finally he rose, made awkward by his weight.
"Ah, damn it, Ned. Did you have to bury her in a place like this?"
His voice was hoarse with remembered grief.
"She deserved more than darkness."
"She was a Stark of Winterfell," Ned said quietly. "This is her place.
She should be on a hill somewhere under a fruit tree, with the sun and clouds above her and the rain to wash her clean."
"I was with her when she died," Ned reminded the king. "She wanted to come home, to rest, beside Brandon and father." He could hear her still at times. "Promise me," she had cried, in a room that smelled of blood and roses. "Promise me, Ned." The fever had taken her strength, and her voice had been faint as a whisper. But when he gave her his word, the fear had gone out of his sister's eyes. Ned remembered the way she had smiled then, how tightly her fingers had clutched his as she gave up her hold on life. The rose petals spilled from her palm, dead and black. After that he remembered nothing. They had found him, still holding her body, silent with grief. The little Crannog man, Harlan Reed, had taken her hand from his. Ned could recall none of it. "I bring her flowers when I can," he said. Lyanna was fond of flowers. The king touched her cheek, his fingers brushing across the rough stone as gently as if it were living flesh.
"I vowed to kill Rhaegar for what he did to her."
"You did," Ned reminded him.
"Only once," Robert said bitterly.
They had come together at the ford of the Trident while the battle crashed around them, Robert with his war hammer and his great antlered helm, the Targaryen prince armoured all in black. On his breastplate was the three-headed dragon of his house, wrought all in rubies that flashed like fire in the sunlight. The waters of the Trident ran red around the hooves of their destriers as they circled and clashed, again and again, until at last a crushing blow from Robert's hammer stove in the dragon and the chest beneath it. When Ned had finally come on the scene, Rhaegar lay dead in the stream, while men of both armies scrambled in the swirling waters for rubies knocked free of his armor.
"In my dreams, I kill him every night," Robert admitted. "A thousand deaths will still be less than he deserves."
There was nothing Ned could say to that. After a quiet, he said, "We should return, Your Grace. Your wife will be waiting."
"The others take my wife,"
Robert muttered sourly, but he started back the way they had come, his footsteps falling heavily.
"And if I hear Your Grace once more, I'll have your head on a spike. We are more to each other than that."
"I had not forgotten," Ned replied quietly. When the king did not answer, he said, "Tell me about John." Robert shook his head.
"I've never seen a man sicken so quickly. We gave her a tourney on my son's name day. If you had seen John then, you would have sworn he would live forever. A fortnight later, he was dead. The sickness was like a fire in his gut. It burned right through him."
He paused beside a pillar before the tomb of a Londed Stark.
"I love that old man."
"We both did," Ned paused a moment. "Catelyn fears for her sister. How does Lysa bear her grief?" Robert's mouth gave a bitter twist. Not well, in truth, he admitted. I think losing John has driven the woman mad, Ned. She has taken the boy back to the Eyrie. Against my wishes, I'd hoped to foster him with Tywin Lannister at Casterly Rock. John had no brothers, no other sons. Was I supposed to leave him to be raised by women? Ned would sooner entrust a child to a pit viper than Lord Tywin, but he left his doubts unspoken. Some old wounds never truly heal, and bleed again at the slightest word. "The wife has lost the husband," he said carefully. "Perhaps a mother feared to lose a son. The boy is very young." "Six, and sickly, and Lord of the Eyrie, God have mercy," the king swore. "Lord Tywin has never taken a ward before. Lysa ought to have been honoured. The Lannisters are a great and noble house. She refused to even hear of it. Then she left in the dead of night, without so much as a by your leave. Cersei was furious." He sighed deeply. "The boy is my namesake. Did you know that? Robert Arryn. I'm sworn to protect him. How can I do that if his mother steals him away?"
"I will take him as ward if you wish," Ned said. "Lysa should consent to that. She and Catelyn were close as girls, and she would be welcome here as well."
"A generous offer, my friend," the king said, "but too late. Lord Tywin has already given his consent. Fostering the boy elsewhere would be a grievous affront to him."
"I have more concern for my nephew's welfare than I do for Lannister pride," Ned declared.
"That is because you do not sleep with a Lannister," Robert laughed, the sound rattling among the tombs and bouncing from the vaulted ceiling. His smile was a flash of white teeth in the thicket of the huge black beard.
"Ah, Ned," he said, "you're still too serious."
He put a massive arm around Ned's shoulders.
"I had planned to wait a few days to speak to you, but I see now there's no need for it. Come, walk with me."
They started back down between the pillars. Blind stone eyes seemed to follow them as they passed. The king kept his arm around Ned's shoulder.
"You must have wondered why I finally came north to Winterfell after so long."
Ned had his suspicions, but he did not give them voice. "For the joy of my company, surely," he said lightly. "And there is the wall. You need to see it, Your Grace, to walk along its battlements and talk to those who man it. The Night's Watch is a shadow of what it once was.
Benjen says, "No doubt I will hear what your brother says soon enough," Robert said. "The wall has stood for what? 8,000 years. It can keep a few days more. I have more pressing concerns. These are difficult times. I need good men about me. Men like John Arryn. He served the Lord of the Eyrie, as Warden of the East, as the Hand of the King. He will not be easy to replace."
"His son," Ned began,
"his son will succeed to the Eyrie and all its incomes," Robert said brusquely. "No more."
That took Ned by surprise. He stopped startled and turned to look at his king. The words came unbidden. "The Arryns have always been wardens of the East. The title goes with the domain."
"Perhaps when he comes of age, the honour can be restored to him," Robert said. "I have this year to think of, and next. A six-year-old boy is no war leader, Ned."
"In peace, the title is only an honour. Let the boy keep it, for his father's sake, if not his own. Surely you owe John that much for his service." The king was not pleased. He took his arm from around Ned's shoulders.
"John's service was a duty he owed his liege lord. I'm not ungrateful, Ned. You of all men ought to know that. But the son is not the father. A mere boy cannot hold the East."
Then his tone softened.
"Enough of this. There is more important office to discuss, and I would not argue with you."
Robert grasped Ned by the elbow.
"I have need of you, Ned."
"I'm yours to command, Your Grace, always." They were words he had to say, and so he said them, apprehensive about what might come next. Robert scarcely seemed to hear him.
"Those years we spent in the Eyrie, gods, they were good years. I want you at my side again, Ned. I want you down in King's Landing, not up here at the end of the world, where you're no damn use to anybody."
Robert looked into the darkness, for a moment as melancholy as a stark.
"I swear to you,
Sitting a throne is 1,000 times harder than winning one. Law's a tedious business, and counting copies is worse, and the people, there's no end of 'em. I sit on that damnable iron chair, listen to them complain until my mind is numb and my ass is raw. They all want something, money or land or justice. The lies they tell, and my lord and ladies are no better. I'm surrounded by flatterers and fools. It can drive a man to madness, Ned. Half of them don't dare tell me the truth, and the other half can't find it. There are nights I wish we had lost at the Trident. No, not truly, but...
I understand, Ned said softly. Robert looked at him. I think you do. If so, you're the only one, my old friend. He smiled. Lord Eddard Stark, I would name you the Hand of the King. Ned dropped to one knee. The offer did not surprise him. What other reason could Robert have for coming so far? The Hand of the King was the second most powerful man in the Seven Kingdoms. He spoke with the king's voice, commanded the king's armies, drafted the king's laws. At times he even sat upon the Iron Throne to dispense king's justice, when the king was absent or sick or otherwise indisposed. Robert was offering him a responsibility as large as the realm itself. It was the last thing in the world he wanted. "Your Grace," he said, "I am not worthy of the honour." Robert groaned with good-humoured impatience.
"If I wanted to honour you, I'd let you retire. I'm planning to make you run the kingdom and fight the wars while I eat and drink and wench myself into an early grave."
He slapped his gut and grinned. "You know the saying about the king and his hand?"
Ned knew the saying. "What the king dreams," he said, "the hand builds."
I wedded a fish maid once who told me that the low-born have a choice way to put it. The king eats, they say, and the hand takes the shit. He threw back his head and roared with laughter. The echoes rang through the darkness, and all around them the dead of Winterfell seemed to watch with cold and disapproving eyes.
Finally, the laughter dwindled and stopped. Ned was still on one knee, his eyes upraised.
"Damn it, Ned," the king complained. "You might at least humour me with a smile."
"They say it grows so cold up here in winter that a man's laughter freezes in his throat and chokes him to death," Ned said evenly. "Perhaps that is why the Starks have so little humour."
"Come south with me, and I'll teach you how to laugh again," the king promised. "You help me win this damnable throne, now help me hold it. We were meant to rule together. If Lyanna had lived, we should have been brothers, bound by blood as well as affection. Well, it is not too late. I have a son, you have a daughter, eh? My Joff and your Sansa shall join our houses, as Lyanna and I might once have done."
This offer did surprise him. "Sansa is only 11. Robert waved an impatient hand. "Old enough for betrothal. The marriage can wait a few years," the king smiled. "Now stand up and say yes, curse you."
"Nothing would give me greater pleasure, Your Grace," Ned answered. He hesitated. "These honours are all so unexpected. May I have some time to consider? I need to tell my wife."
"Yes, yes, of course. Tell Catelyn. Sleep on it if you must."
The king reached down, clasped Ned by the hand, and pulled him roughly to his feet.
"Just don't keep me waiting too long. I'm not the most patient of men."
For a moment, Eddard Stark was filled with a terrible sense of foreboding. This was his place, here in the north. He looked at the stone figures all around him, breathed deep in the chill silence of the crypt. He could feel the eyes of the dead. They were all listening, he knew. And winter was coming.
John. There were times, not many, but a few, when Jon Snow was glad he was a bastard.
As he filled his wine cup once more from a passing flagon, it struck him that this might be one of them. He settled back in his place on the bench among the younger squires and drank. The sweet, fruity taste of summer wine filled his mouth and brought a smile to his lips. The great hall of Winterfell was hazy with smoke and heavy with the smell of roasted meat and fresh-baked bread. Its grey stone walls were draped with banners, white, gold, crimson, the direwolf of Stark, Baratheon's crowned stag, the lion of Lannister. A singer was playing the high harp and reciting a ballad, but down at this end of the hall his voice could scarcely be heard above the roar of the fire, the clangor of pewter plates and cups, and the low mutter of 100 drunken conversations. It was the fourth hour of the welcoming feast laid for the king. John's brothers and sisters had been seated with the royal children beneath the raised platform where Lord and Lady Stark hosted the king and queen. In honour of the occasion, his lord father would doubtless permit each child a glass of wine, but no more than that. Down here on the benches, there was no one to stop John drinking as much as he had a thirst for. And he was finding that he had a man's thirst, to the raucous delight of the youths around him, who urged him on every time he drained a glass. They were fine company, and John relished the stories they were telling, tales of battle and bedding and the hunt. He was certain that his companions were more entertaining than the king's offspring. He had sated his curiosity about the visitors when they had made their entrance. The procession had passed not a foot from the place he had been given on the bench, and John had gotten a good, long look at them all. His lord father had come first, escorting the queen. She was as beautiful as men said. A jewelled tiara gleamed amidst her long golden hair, its emeralds a perfect match for the green of her eyes. His father helped her up the steps to the dais and led her to her seat, but the queen never so much as looked at him. Even at 14, John could see through her smile. Next had come King Robert himself, with Lady Stark on his arm. The king was a great disappointment to John. His father had talked of him often, the peerless Robert Baratheon, demon of the trident, the fiercest warrior of the realm, a giant among princes. John saw only a fat man, red-faced under his beard, sweating through his silks. He walked like a man half in his cups. After them came the children. Little Rickon first, managing the long walk with all the dignity a three-year-old could muster. John had to urge him on when he stopped to visit. Close behind came Rob, in grey wool trimmed with white, the Stark colours. He had the Princess Marcella on his arm. She was a wisp of a girl, not quite 8, her hair a cascade of golden curls under a jewelled net. John noticed the shy look she gave Rob as they passed between the tables, and the timid way she smiled at him. He decided she was insipid. Rob didn't even have the sense to realize how stupid she was. He was grinning like a fool. His half-sisters escorted the royal princes. Arya was paired with plump young Tommen, whose white blonde hair was longer than hers. Sansa, 2 years older, drew the crown prince, Joffrey Baratheon. He was 12, younger than John or Rob, but taller than either, to John's vast dismay. Prince Joffrey had his sister's hair and his mother's deep green eyes. A thick tangle of blonde curls dripped down past his golden choker and high velvet collar. Sansa looked radiant as she walked beside him. But John did not like Joffrey's pouty lips, or the bored, disdainful way he looked at Winterfell's great hall. He was more interested in the pair that came behind him, the Queen's brothers, the Lannisters of Casterly Rock. The Lion and the Imp. There was no mistaking which was which. Sir Jaime Lannister was twin to Queen Cersei, tall and golden, with flashing green eyes and a smile that cut like a knife. He wore crimson silk, high black boots, a black satin cloak. On the breast of his tunic, the lion of his house was embroidered in gold thread, roaring its defiance. They called him the Lion of Lannister to his face, and whispered, "Kingslayer," behind his back. John found it hard to look away from him. "This is what a king should look like," he thought to himself as the man passed. Then he saw the other one, waddling along, half hidden by his brother's side. Tyrion Lannister, the youngest of Lord Tywin's brood, and by far the ugliest. All that the guards had given to Cersei and Jaime, they had denied Tyrion. He was a dwarf, half his brother's height, struggling to keep pace on stunted legs. His head was too large for his body, with a brute squashed-in face beneath a swollen shelf of brow. One green eye and one black one peered from under a lank fall of hair, so blond it seemed white. John watched him with fascination. The last of the High Lords to enter were his uncle, Benjen Stark, of the Night's Watch, and his father's ward, young Theon Greyjoy. Benjen gave John a warm smile as he went by. Theon ignored him utterly, but there was nothing new in that. After all had been seated, toasts were made. Thanks were given and returned, and then the feasting began. John had started drinking then, and he had not stopped. Something rubbed against his leg beneath the table. John saw red eyes staring up at him. "Hungry again?" he asked. There was still half a honey chicken in the center of the table. John reached out to tear off a leg. Then he had a better idea. He knifed the bird whole and let the carcass slide to the floor between his legs. Ghost ripped into it in savage silence. His brothers and sisters had not been permitted to bring their old wolves to the banquet. But there were more curs than John could count at this end of the hall. And no one had said a word about his pup. He told himself he was fortunate in that, too. His eyes stung. John rubbed at them savagely, cursing the smoke. He swallowed another gulp of wine and watched his dire wolf devour the chicken. Dogs moved between the tables, trailing after the serving girls. One of them, a black mongrel bitch with long yellow eyes, caught a scent of the chicken. She stopped and edged under the bench to get a share. John watched the confrontation. The bitch growled low in her throat and moved closer. Ghost looked up, silent, and fixed the dog with those hot red eyes. The bitch snapped an angry challenge. She was three times the size of the dire wolf pup. Ghost did not move. He stood over his prize and opened his mouth, baring his fangs. The bitch tensed, barked again, then thought better of this fight. She turned and slunk away, with one last defiant snap to save her pride. Ghost went back to his meal. John grinned and reached under the table to ruffle the shaggy white fur. The direwolf looked up at him, nipped gently at his hand, then went back to eating. "Is this one of the direwolves I've heard so much about?" a familiar voice asked close at hand. John looked up happily as his Uncle Ben put a hand on his head and ruffled his hair, much as John had ruffled the wolf's. "Yes," he said, "his name is Ghost." One of the squires interrupted the bawdy story he'd been telling to make room at the table for their lord's brother. Benjen Stark straddled the bench with long legs and took the wine cup out of John's hand. "Summer wine," he said after a taste. "Nothing so sweet. How many cups have you had, John?" John smiled. Ben Stark laughed. "As I feared. Well, I believe I was younger than you the first time I got truly and sincerely drunk." He snagged a roasted onion, dripping brown with gravy, from a nearby trencher, and bit into it. It crunched. His uncle was sharp-featured and gaunt as a mountain crag, but there was always a hint of laughter in his blue-grey eyes. He dressed in black, as befitted a man of the Night's Watch. Tonight it was rich black velvet, with high leather boots and a wide belt with a silver buckle. A heavy silver chain was looped round his neck. Benjen watched Ghost with amusement as he ate his onion. "A very quiet wolf," he observed. "He's not like the others," John said. "He never makes a sound. That's why I named him Ghost. That, and because he's white. The others are all dark, grey or black. There are still dire wolves beyond the wall. We hear them on our rangings." Benjen Stark gave John a long look. "Don't you usually eat at table with your brothers?" "Most times," John answered in a flat voice, "but tonight Lady Stark thought it might give insult to the royal family to see the bastard among them."
"I see,"
His uncle glanced over his shoulder at the raised table at the far end of the hall.
"My brother does not seem very festive tonight."
John had noticed that, too. A bastard had to learn